6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The United States says it's providing another 200 troops and several attack helicopters to assist Iraqi forces in the fight to retake the northern city Mosul, captured by Islamic State 2 years ago. The announcement came from Defense Secretary Ashton Carter Monday in Baghdad.
We are going to place additional advisors with the Iraqi security forces now down to brigade and battalion headquarters. We're going to make available attack helicopters in support of the ISF's ongoing efforts to envelop and then retake Mosul.
He also announced U.S. is increasing funding for Kurdish Peshmerga forces. President Obama spoke of the new support during a CBS television interview Monday.
As we see the Iraqis willing to fight and gaining ground, let's make sure that we're providing them more support. We're not doing the fighting ourselves, but when we provide training, when we provide special forces who are backing them up, when we are gaining intelligence, working with the coalitions that we have, what we've seen is that we can continually tighten the noose.
Mr. Obama said he expects by year's end the conditions will be set for Mosul to fall. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke Monday with South Sudan's president and the top rebel leader, urging them to quickly establish their transitional government. Rebel leader Riek Machar is preparing to return to the capital, Juba, to be sworn in as its first vice president and set up the government with President Salva Kiir. He's expected to arrive Tuesday. South Sudan erupted into civil war in December 2013, 6 months after Mr. Kiir fired Machar as vice president. 2.5 years of fighting has killed tens of thousands, displaced more than 2 million South Sudanese. This is VOA News. The future of UN-sponsored Syrian peace talks in Geneva is uncertain after opposition negotiators Monday announced they're delaying involvement in the formal negotiations until Damascus agrees to discuss the establishment of a transitional government. UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura remains hopeful the talks will not collapse.
They told us, however, their intention to remain in Geneva and possibly, at my own suggestion, to pursue technical discussions with myself and my team, particularly on the issues related to Resolution 2254 and the political transition.
Rebel negotiator Mohamed Alouche warned the truce has, quote, effectively been ended by the regime. He said the Assad government, backed by Russian warplanes, carried out multiple airstrikes Sunday and said Iran had sent more troops to reinforce government forces in the fight for the northern city of Aleppo. Israeli police say a bomb blast ripped through a commuter bus Monday in an industrial area of Jerusalem, wounding more than 20 people. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu linked the blast to terrorism. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is to meet his Iranian counterpart, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, at the U.N. Tuesday over Tehran's concerns about the perceived lack of sanctions relief. Iranian officials have complained their country is not getting the sanctions relief specified in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the landmark nuclear agreement that was implemented in January. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
We're obviously aware of these concerns that they've expressed about the status of sanctions relief. And the secretary is very mindful that that topic will come up tomorrow, that is very much on Foreign Minister Zarif's mind. It is, I wasn't trying to be glib, but it's all part of discussing the implementation of JCPOA. And from their perspective, this is very much an implementation issue. And he'll be prepared to discuss that with them.
A White House spokesman last week said the U.S. has been fulfilling its commitments under the JCPOA. Hundreds of East African migrants are believed dead after their boat capsized in the eastern Mediterranean. Witnesses and survivors told VOA the vessel overturned while carrying as many as 500 people. The incident occurred April 8th, but first was reported by the BBC late Sunday. At least 4 civilians and a militant were killed in a shoot-off Monday in the Somali capital Mogadishu after gunmen opened fire on government officials in a car. A spokesman for the Al-Shabaab group claimed responsibility. Asian markets gained in trading Tuesday after New York's benchmark Dow Jones average climbed back above 18,000 points Monday for the first time since July. Oil prices also edged higher after oil workers in Kuwait went out on strike. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Could today be the day that South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar finally returns to Juba?
At Gambela Ethiopia Airport, it shall take off at around 7:30 p.m. It shall arrive at Juba Airport at 9:30 p.m. After 3 hours' time, the first vice president designated Dr. Riek Machar shall land in Juba Airport at around 1 p.m.
Colonel William Gadjia Deng is South Sudan rebel military spokesman. We'll get analysis of what Machar's return means for peace in South Sudan. Zimbabwe marked 36 years of independence yesterday, Monday, and Liberia's Electoral Commission chair warns against violating the country's election laws ahead of the 2017 presidential elections.
The business of election has to be conducted in an atmosphere of transparency, fair, and it has to be credible. And to do that, people must live within the rules.
Councillor Jerome Kokoya is chairman of the National Elections Commission of Liberia. An elite Somali land school prepares students for studies abroad, and the fifth community urges world leaders to sign a climate pact. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan rebels say their leader, Riek Machar, will finally make his much-anticipated return to Juba today, Tuesday. He had been expected to arrive yesterday, Monday, but with red carpet rolled out and dignitaries assembled to welcome him, Machar, who is first vice president-designate, was a no-show, disappointing many. Rebel military spokesman Colonel William Gadjia Deng says the rebels changed Mr. Machar's arrival date because the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, known as JMEC, had demanded Mr. Machar arrive in Juba before his chief of general staff, contrary to the peace agreement. But Deng says the matter has been resolved and the chief of general staff will arrive in Juba this morning and soon after Mr. Machar will arrive.
The first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar, should arrive in Juba at 9 a.m. in the morning. But there are a number of reasons we have changed the date, because the JMAX were demanding the arrival of the first vice president to Juba before the coming of chief of general staff of the SLAIO. Today, we were really working hard so that our chief of general staff can go first and can arrive at Juba airport and should welcome the first vice president. Now, the chief of general staff for the SLAIO and the IGP of South Sudan National Police, SLAIO, are overnight at Gambela Ethiopia Airport, which shall take off at around 7:30 p.m. Tomorrow morning, which shall arrive at Juba Airport at 9:30 p.m. After 3 hours' time, the first vice president designated Dr. Riek Machar shall land in Juba Airport at around 1 p.m.
Colonel William, I'm sure that the people of South Sudan are very angry and they are disappointed. The fact that your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, did not arrive on Monday as he promised. So what do you want to say to the people of South Sudan?
The first message that I can pass to the general public of South Sudan is that the first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar, should not come to Juba if the chief of staff of the SLAIO did not touch down the ground in Juba. You know what had happened 2 years ago. We have experienced all this. We were talking to JMAC so that they can welcome our chief of general staff to go first and pave the way for the first vice president to arrive in Juba. This was come late from JMAC, and they made clearance this evening. So we are ready now.
I'm sure the people of South Sudan will be wondering here, why does your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, need your chief of staff to be on the ground in Juba before he comes? You already have forces in South Sudan. Are you going to war?
No, we are not going back to the national capital for war. We are going for the full implementation of peace agreements. But one thing we should know is that always chief of general staff and his leader can go together to implement, because even the peace agreement itself said that the chief of general staff could go first before the coming of the first vice president. We are not going back to war just for the implementation of peace agreement.
Colonel Williams, so where are you now?
I'm in Gambela Airport, Ethiopia.
Gambela Airport, ready to go where? To Juba or to Pagar?
To Juba.
Okay, thank you very much, Colonel Williams. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, dear Hayes.
Colonel William Gadjia Dang, a South Sudan rebel military spokesman. He was speaking with me from Gambela Airport in Ethiopia. A South Sudanese legal expert says the transitional government of national unity to be formed must facilitate the formation of a hybrid court for South Sudan. Legal expert Ajo Noel Julius says justice and accountability are key to achieving a lasting peace in South Sudan. Noel says President Salva Kiir and Machar should help the Monitoring and Evaluation Commission to set up the hybrid courts as stipulated in the August peace deal. He tells John Tanza the soon-to-be-formed transitional government of national unity should not interfere with the work of the hybrid court.
If the people responsible for these crimes are the senior government officers, then given the fact that they control a lot of power, this is going to be a big obstacle to the process of providing justice to the victims, because people are talking of Riek Machar coming in as a first vice president. He will definitely be in control of a lot of state apparatus, and he has his forces here. And let us take, for example, if he's one of the suspects, how will he be availed before the court when he has a lot of support? If President Kiir or any of the army officers has made a suspect by the hybrid court, how will they be held accountable when they have a lot of power or control a lot of state apparatus? So this is where it gives us a lot of doubt, especially when we talk of accountability in the transitional period.
Peace comes with justice, and justice comes with accountability. You cannot separate these three elements. Most people are wondering, when Dr. Riek assumes power, what is going to happen? But you people who are in the legal practice and in the academia, you think fast. Can you give us some of your focus in terms of the government delivering justice to the people who have been hurt, or to the victims, so to speak?
Well, I'm still confident that justice will be delivered, though justice might not be delivered in the way that everybody will expect. Probably the president, the first vice president, will sacrifice some people. Probably people will be identified as to have committed crimes. And probably they'll be like, well, you know, my friend, I have no problem, really. But I think you should go and clear your name before the hybrid court. I am looking at a scenario where some people will be sacrificed in the name of justice, in the name of healing. But if those people will be sacrificed, indeed committed the crimes, then they will not be sacrificed. They will be serving sentences against crime that they are said to have committed. But of course, who is responsible will be determined by the court.
Ajo Noel Julius is a South Sudanese independent legal expert. He was speaking with John Tanza, who is on assignment in Juba. President Robert Mugabe says Zimbabwe has made great strides in addressing issues affecting the majority of its citizens, but analysts are quick to point to the country's high unemployment rate. As Thomas Chiripasi reports from Harare, Mr. Mugabe spoke Monday during ceremonies marking Zimbabwe's 36th independence anniversary.
Officiating at celebrations to mark Zimbabwe's 36th independence anniversary at the National Sports Stadium in Harare, President Mugabe said this achievement was despite the restrictive measures imposed by the West on him and his inner circle.
Some improvements are taking place across the line. Let me also acknowledge that the African Development Bank has been of help, tremendous help to us, and is assisting us with various projects, especially that the sanctions that have been imposed on us by the United States are having their toll.
Although the president said the country's economic environment was improving, the situation on the ground is on the contrary, as evidenced by an unidentified woman who was arrested when Mr. Mugabe arrived at the stadium for demanding food and her share of the missing 15 billion diamond money. Rising unemployment, poverty, and the missing diamond proceeds were some of the reasons why thousands of MDCT supporters took to the streets last week in protest. Mr. Mugabe said his government is working hard to ensure that all Zimbabweans had access to food as the El Nino-induced drought wreaks havoc in the countryside. The president also urged those in government and other sectors of the economy to shun corruption.
One of the greatest tributes we can pay to Zimbabwe is to shun corruption, to shun regionalism, and avoid nepotism. We should always remember that we are one people, united by the bond of independence, the independence we are celebrating today.
Despite the country's poor economic performance, Mr. Mugabe said his administration had tried its best to deal with the power outages, water provision, and road construction, although much still needs to be done.
It is pleasing to note that Air Zimbabwe and the National Railways of Zimbabwe are now steadily on their way to resuscitation.
Turning to the country's 36 years of self-determination, Mr. Mugabe urged Zimbabweans to continuously remember the sacrifices made by the country's freedom fighters. Thousands of people who filled the stadium to capacity were entertained by several musicians to mark 36 years of the country's attainment of independence from British colonial rule. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Today's Tuesday, April 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The chairman of Liberia's Elections Commission is warning individuals and political parties who, he said, are engaged in pre-political campaign activities in violation of election guidelines ahead of the 2017 presidential election. Councillor Jerome Kokoya says the commission will take punitive actions against violators, which may include decertification or suspension in the case of political parties. He would not say which individuals or political parties are violating the election guidelines, but Kokoya said some self-styled groups supporting political parties and or individuals desirous to contest the 2017 elections have been involved in activities that contravene the election laws of Liberia.
It is necessary to do so because the business of election has to be conducted in an atmosphere of transparency, fair, and it has to be credible. And to do that, people must live within the rules. That is, you cannot allow activities that will work prejudice to other parties. Everybody has to be treated fairly, meaning everybody has to start at the same time and be given the same opportunity.
Do you know of any politician or politicians or their political parties that have violated this particular requirement?
At this point, I don't want to say violation because as an institution committed to transparency, what we try to do is to make sure that people are aware of the rules first. As you know, James, currently we have 20 political parties. Most of these people, some are new to the game, so some of them are not pretty much familiar with all of the rules. I'm not trying to defend anybody here. But since one of our guiding principles is to be fair, we believe that some of them may act subconsciously outside of the rules. So we take it that when we see things that resemble border on the violations, the first thing to do is wrong. So it is not necessary that there are particular people violating, but there are activities that are being exhibited in recent times by various groups that resemble or that could border around violations of our rules.
Mr. Chairman, I do receive a lot of emails from different groups. Particularly, I've been getting a lot of emails. They've come from the vice president's office. This one says, Lofa chiefs speak out. Quote, we Lofians are plainly resolved and fully prepared to support our kinsmen for the position of president come 2017 simply because he is what it takes to move the country to another level. What is acceptable and what is not acceptable?
People can certainly express their desire to support a particular person. For example, you could say, well, I like James Bobby. He's like a good person to be friends. You can say that as an individual. But what you cannot do is to begin to engage in activities that will solicit votes for that person, that will influence other people to vote for that person for political reasons.
other than speaking to the media and issuing the press statement, what can you do in terms of punitive action?
Oh, certainly, we can do a lot. And we said, we mentioned in our statement, if you violate some of these activities when they are determined to be in violation of certain part of our guidelines, election law, because I think certain part, because I think it's chapter 10 that has to do with that treat certain violations as offenses, and they are punishable in the minor portion of a crime, and they are prosecuted by the Ministry of Justice that one way. We also have authority to the certificate people, political parties that is, who violate our regulations that have the potential to undermine the credibility of the commission and the whole process.
Councillor Jerome Kokoya is chairman of the National Elections Commission of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. On the outskirts of Hargeisa, Somaliland, is the Abaso School of Science and Technology. High achievers from around Somaliland and some from the diaspora come there to study, live, and attempt to get into prestigious schools around the world. As Joel Craig reports from Hargeisa, it seems to be working.
If you suffer that, I close one. Negative square root of negative one.
That's the voice of Mustafa Mohammed Ibrahim, a recent graduate of the Abaso School of Science and Technology. He's helping younger classmates with math problems they might encounter on the ACT, an American college entrance exam.
I left this place. I left the people. I left the students.
But the 8th and 9th graders he's teaching aren't studying in the United States, at least not yet. Abaso is an elite school located outside Hargeisa, Somaliland, teaching students from 7th to 12th grades, and it's competitive. Prospective 7th grade students must take an entrance exam, in which 500 or 600 of them compete for 50 spots. This year, at least 1,000 students were expected to take the test. Once students are accepted, the rigorous curriculum, focused on math, science, and technology, while helping them become fully conversant in English, provides international opportunities. According to school headmaster James Linville, 80 students are studying at or have been accepted to universities and secondary schools throughout the world, with nearly half of them on full scholarship.
Well, it's incredibly competitive to get scholarships as international students to these schools. And not only that, but it's been a very long time since Somali-educated and Somali-raised students were able to get these scholarships. So actually, when our first students got scholarships 3 years ago, they were the first in over a generation to be given scholarships to study in the U.S.
Ibrahim, who was recently accepted to New York's University of Rochester with a full scholarship, says he's happy for opportunities that were beyond his parents' reach.
For a kid who his parents never graduated from middle school, it's, of course, it is very, very big deal for getting accepted to universities in the States.
There are now 40 Abaso alumni in the United States alone, studying at schools like Harvard, MIT, Georgetown, Amherst, and Carnegie Mellon. And once abroad, they are keeping up with their international counterparts. Linville says that Abaso students have an average grade point average of 3.2 in college and prep school and have scored exceptionally high on the SAT, another American college entrance exam. The Abaso school was started by an American financier named Jonathan Starr, who took a trip to his uncle's native Somaliland in 2008 and decided to open a school there, using $500,000 of his own money to do so. Jill Craig, VOA News, Hargeisa.
On Earth Day, Friday, April 22nd, world leaders will come together to sign the Global Climate Change Agreement negotiated in Paris last December. The ceremony at the United Nations headquarters in New York marks the first step in the ratification process. As VOA's Roseanne Scarbo reports, a contingent of 5 leaders issued a statement yesterday that expresses solidarity with the agreement and the need for rapid action to put it into action.
Religious leaders joined in prayer at the UN chapel to affirm the sanctity of the earth. Their joint statement, signed by 250 eminent faith leaders, urges heads of state to quickly sign, ratify, and implement the Paris Climate Agreement. Their campaign is backed by nearly 5,000 individuals and 90 groups worldwide, says Fletcher Harper, who heads an interfaith coalition that helped organize the event.
The statement reflects that we must regard the earth as a gift, not just as a commodity that can be bought or sold, but as a gift that must be cherished and protected, not only for short-term economic gain, but for the long-term protection of life. These are fundamental moral and religious values that are shared by traditions across the world.
Among those at the event was Karen Bali, global chairperson for the United Religions Initiative, an interfaith group active in 94 countries.
For many of us, we are seeing the problem across the world: drought, food shortages, extinction of species. I feel that this is a human and a spiritual failure. And I'm here to ask for everybody to unite, to come together as people of faith who believe in the values of oneness and respect, environmental stewardship, and really save our planet, save our Earth.
Faith leaders called for a move to renewable sources of energy to keep global temperature rise below 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial times.
That's VOA Roseanne Scarbo reporting from Washington. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Atsebe Beisa clocked 2 hours, 29 minutes and 19 seconds to lead Tirfe Tsegei in a 1-2 Ethiopian triumph in the women's contest as Kenyan Joyce Chepkurui placed third at the Boston Marathon in Massachusetts State, United States of America on Monday. Meanwhile, Behanu Haile covered the distance in 2 hours, 12 minutes and 45 seconds to lead defending champion Lelisa Desisa and Yamane Adane Tsegei in a 1-2-3 Ethiopian medal podium sweep in the men's contest. Meanwhile, Kenyan Rachel Mutga won the women's race in 2 hours 31 minutes and 24 seconds at the Lutz Marathon in Poland on Sunday. Ethiopian Abrao Misganao prevailed in the men's event. Elsewhere, Kenyan Jairus Chanchima and Ethiopian Shasho Insermu triumphed in the men's and women's races respectively at the Nagano Marathon in Japan on Sunday. In Tanzania, the East Africa Junior Track and Field Athletics Championship takes place in Dar es Salaam today, Tuesday. The annual event features youngsters from Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, Uganda, and hosts Tanzania. Turning to football, Morocco pipped Libya 3-2 as Egypt outwitted Angola 4-2 at the African Futsal Cup of Nations here in Johannesburg, South Africa on Monday. Morocco lead Group B with 6 points. Egypt have 4, Libya 1, while Angola have no point. Today, Tuesday, Mozambique play Zambia as Tunisia challenge South Africa in the final Group A preliminaries. Mozambique topped the group with 6 points. South Africa and Zambia are tied with 3 points each, while Tunisia has no point. Turning to rugby, Namibia tackled the United States of America at the start of the World Rugby Under-20 Trophy in Harare, Zimbabwe today, Tuesday. Hong Kong and Spain are the other teams in Group B, while Zimbabwe will engage Samoa in Group A, which also includes Fiji and Uruguay. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Hundreds of East African migrants are believed dead after their boat capsized in the Eastern Mediterranean. Witnesses and survivors told VOA Monday that the vessel overturned while carrying as many as 500 people. An unknown number swam to boats nearby and were later picked up and taken to Greece. The incident happened April 8, but was first reported by the BBC later on Sunday. And that is it for this Tuesday, April 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
Can't get enough of the sunny side of sports? Well, we've solved that problem. We now have a half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. So visit voanews.com for more details and enjoy the show.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the 2016 World Bank IMF Spring Meetings. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa, next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.